Well, first of all, I want to thank you for the invitation. It's always a great pleasure to come back to Perimeter, and especially on such an auspicious day. Like today, it's not just Halloween, but today, maybe you remember, it's Brexit Day. So to commemorate the occasion, then they sort of printed new coins, 50p coins. But as you know, it didn't happen. So that's the proposed new design. It seems rather appropriate. So today I'm going to talk about real-time dynamic Basel balls, if you can find it background. And this is work in progress with Hans Vantilan, also at Queen Mary, and David Mateos in Barcelona. So if during the talk you have any questions, just feel free to interrupt me and try to answer them. And if we keep disagreeing, then maybe we can settle the issue in the ice hockey way. Since given that I've been given a stick, then that seems to be the way to go. So since it's a rather diverse audience, you're mostly sort of into GR, these sort of things, I will start with like a gentle introduction slash reminder of holography, because this is the main motivation for our work, and this is the actual context where our work is placed. So just to remind you, holography is this conjecture, also known under the name of gauge gravity duality, which was put forward by Maldacena in the late 90s, which in a certain limit states that a certain strongly interacting gauge theory, namely n equals source for Young Mills, which is has many features in common with real-world gauge theories, is actually equivalent to general relativity in anti de Sitter space. So this conjecture is a strong, weak type equivalence relation between the two sides, because this side is strongly interacting, whilst this on the other side we have weakly coupled gravity, which is just classical and general relativity. So the fact that this is a strong, weak duality makes it hard to prove, but at the same time useful to use, right? Because one can address questions in a strongly interacting regime of a quantum field theory by just solving classical Einstein's equations with these boundary conditions. So for the purposes of this talk, we will use GR as a way to calculate properties of this strongly interacting gauge theory. So as I said, so for the purposes of this talk, we will use holography as a tool, because it gives us access to the strongly interacting regime of a certain strongly a certain quantum field theory. And I should emphasize that in this duality, this tool is a first principles tool. So as long as general relativity is valid in these spacetimes, then this is a perfectly consistent setting to address questions in the gauge theory. And this is particularly useful in this out of equilibrium regime, because basically there are no first principles tools in quantum field theory that allows you to calculate in this regime. Whilst, as I said, thanks to this conjecture, we can address those issues for a certain class of theories by just solving the Einstein equations. So in principle, what one has to do is to map a certain physics problem that you are interested in to the analogous evolution of some asymptotically ADS spacetimes. And I want to emphasize that with this approach, one should not aim to just get precise numbers or numbers that one can compare with experiments, because these gauge theories may or may not have anything to do with the real world ones. So what we're trying to do is to try to understand some universal behavior so that you can then apply it to the real world gauge theories. Whether this is possible or not, this has to be checked in a case by case basis. Or it depends on the type of questions you are addressing. Yes?
Should we not be concerned about the fact that we live in a de Sitter space, not an anti de Sitter space?
It depends on what questions you are trying to address. If you want to learn about our universe, then this doesn't work, because, as you said, we are in a de Sitter space. But if you want to use this as a tool to learn about quantum field theory, then these are the right spaces that one has to consider. So it's just a matter of what question you are addressing. And there is, or holography is not developed nor well understood for the de Sitter spaces. And so it's not clear whether this exists in the first place. So So it's only in the case of antidesita space that this conjecture is precisely formulated.
How do we connect the results to experiment?
I will come to this point in a bit, and if it's not clear, just please ask again. So again, so what we have to do in this setting is we have to solve the Einstein equations in asymptotically ADS spacetimes. So these spacetimes have a time-like boundary. So what one has to deal with is with an initial boundary value problem. So one has to provide boundary conditions, and this defines also the problem. So one remarkable thing that holography has led to is that it has led us to develop new intuition about strongly coupled quantum field theories based on geometry. So up until very recently, one kind of thought about quantum field theory in terms of Feynman diagrams. This gives you some kind of idea of what's going on. But holography has provided a new way to think about quantum field theory. It's just translate the problem into some geometry. And this has led to study dynamics of antidesita spacetime. And of course, these spacetimes are fundamentally different in many ways to asymptotically flat space. So there are new gravitational phenomena that are unique to antidesita space. For example, one of these is turbulence, gravitational turbulence, and related issues, which flat space are maybe not as apparent. So this program has, as I said, led to discovery of new gravitational phenomena, which would otherwise have never been discovered. And since in this talk we will be interested in studying physics of these quantum field theories at finite temperature, then one, this finite temperature regime in a quantum field theory maps to a spacetime containing a black hole. So if we want to study this regime, then we have to understand the evolution of black hole spacetimes in asymptotic ADS space. Yes.
We don't know if it is unique to asymptotic ADS space, but we are here otherwise.
It depends on which phenomenon. For example, turbulence, yes, it may not be unique. But for example, that the class of black holes that you have may have no analogs in flat space. And yeah, solitonic solutions, then you don't have them in flat space. So one situation where this program has been used extensively with may or may not so much success is to model heavy ion collisions. So the motivation for this is because in experiments, more specifically at the LHC, one collides heavy nuclei. And after these nuclei collide, they form a fireball consisting of quarks and gluons, which even though the energies reached at the LHC are above the QCD phase transition, the system is still strongly interacting. And what has been observed experimentally is that this fireball behaves as one of the most perfect fluids in nature. So it is very hard to model this system in using QCD or quantum field theory, precisely because the system is strongly interacting and very far from equilibrium. And the only first principles tool that can be used to access this strongly interacting out of equilibrium regime of quantum field theory is holography by simulating some, say, for example, black hole type collisions. As I said, once you've done this calculation in another theory, then you can look at what the behavior in this holographic model is, and from this, try to understand whether there's anything which can be useful to understand the real world experiments. But as I said, here you're not pretending to come up with numbers that you can then go and compare with experiments. That's not what we can do. So more specifically, in a heavy ion collision, what one does, you send two nuclei which move close to the speed of light. So they are highly pancake and move in these null trajectories almost. Then you form, they collide. There's some outgoing stuff. But in the central region in the collision, then this is, you form a fireball, which is far from equilibrium, and you don't really know anything about the system in these early stages of the collision. But what's been observed is that very quickly after the collision, the system turns out to be very well described by hydrodynamics. At some point, as the fireball expands in a hydrodynamic way, it reaches the QCD phase transition temperature, and then, as you know, there cannot be free quarks and gluons, then they form hadrons, which are the particles that then interact between themselves. That's stage number three. Finally, they decouple and they reach the detector. So from these events, you try to reconstruct what happens over here and try to measure fundamental properties of your quantum field theory, namely QCD. So one of the open questions in this field is, what are the initial conditions for hydrodynamics? When and how hydrodynamics becomes applicable? And as I said, there's really no first principles tool to address this question. Another important point, as I said, is that QCD is a confining gauge theory. So at some point, it forms hadrons. So how does this happen? And like I said, there's no way to know this from QCD. Also, these nuclei that you collide, they are finite nuclei. They are inhomogeneous. And all these features do have an impact into the actual distribution of particles that you get in the detector. So we would like to get a holographic model that allows us to cover all these different stages in a collision. And as I said, once you have this, then you can go back and see whether this is relevant or not for real-world experiments, or to what extent. So colliding black holes to model heavy ions, this is not something new. It was pioneered by these two gentlemen a few years ago. And what they did was to collide gravitational shock waves in asymptotically ADS spacetime. So what they did, they considered like a black hole in ADS, which has splendid topology. And you consider a perturbation, which can be large and moves at the speed of light. So in fact, what you have is infinite sheets of energy with some deformation that collide. This is the collision region. And then this has a collision region. Then the plasma that you read off from gravity expands. And it is this region in the middle that you try to then measure, try to infer the properties of the plasma in this region here and compare with the actual experiments. So there's a dictionary that allows you to translate the quantities that you compute from gravity to gauge theory quantities. And then, as I said, you can try to see whether this region over here is well modeled or not by hydrodynamics, when and how this happens. In this context, most of the work has been done in ADS. And the dictionary tells us that the quantum field theory that you measure, or what that is dual to, is a conformal field theory. It means it has no intrinsic scale, it has no particles, and QCD is not conformal, even though there's a region after the collision that one can argue that QCD behaves in an almost conformal way. And that's why these models have worked relatively well to explain some of the features that you observe. In particular, they work pretty well in explaining why hydrodynamics takes over very, very soon after the collision. But they miss out other important pieces which relate to the fact that in QCD you have a phase transition at some point. And in QCD, what you observe particles in the detector, in a conformal field theory, there are no particles. So the success that these models have had is, in a way, limited because the theories that you can model in this context have important differences with QCD. So the question is, can we do a better job? So as I said, we would like to construct a holographic model that has more features in common with QCD than what has been done so far. So what we're going to do in this talk is to consider precisely a model which is dual to a gauge theory with confinement. So in particular, we can address all the various stages that I alluded to in the previous slide. When, how hydrodynamics becomes valid, because in a theory which is non-conformal, you can have particles, then you can look at the distribution of particles that follow from this collision, say. You can study how these various particles interact, and so on and so forth. And the way this works, is again, is the ADS-CFD, or gauge gravity duality dictionary. So you solve for the evolution of the space-time, and once you have that, there's a well-defined way to extract observables for the gauge theory. Yes?
So how do you develop the dictionary that maps from one to the other?
This has been more than 20 years worth of work to try to develop this dictionary. So basically, the equivalent is an equivalent relation between the partition functions of, say, string theory of supergravity and the partition function in the quantum field theory. So then from this, you can infer what translates into what. So this has been well developed to some extent.
But it's more by analogy. You're very much like understanding black hole thermodynamics.
No, actually, in this case, there's a precise way. So in particular, from these space times, there's a very well-defined way to extract, for example, the stress-energy tensor of the field theory. And so in particular, you can use that to then compare with the hydrodynamic stress-energy tensor. So from gravity, for example, there's a well-defined procedure to compute, say, transport coefficients. So these are all observables that you can also compute in principle in a gauge theory. The problem is that in all the tools that you have in gauge theories, you can only use them at weak coupling in a perturbative regime. So but there's a well-defined procedure to do that. OK, any other questions?
Years ago, Michael Duff published a paper in PhysRev where he added up all the tree graphs, graviton tree graphs, on the Schwarzschild solution. So, no loops.
And?
The result that I fit in.
So, by doing this, what you will be doing is construct the gravity effective action that would go beyond the tree level Einstein-Hilbert term. So you would consider these higher curvature terms in the action. After all, gravity is an effective field theory. So that's what this is about. So in this context, we only consider the strict supergravity limit. So you have basically Einstein-Hilbert. And this maps into this strong coupling large n limit of the gauge theory. So in order to be sensitive to these extra terms that you would have in the Lagrangian, then you need to be able to compute this corresponds to 1 over n effects in the gauge theory. So these are quantum effects in a way. So here we ignore all of that, and we restrict ourselves strictly to the classical regime.
Gravity is notoriously weak.
Yes?
So you're talking about strong coupling.
Yes, so gravity is notoriously, so precisely because this duality is a strong weak duality. So the fact that gravity is extremely weak, so it's classical, maps to the opposite regime in the quantum field theory, which is infinitely strongly coupled. So that's why I said earlier that this conjecture is both useful and hard to prove. Because whilst you can compute one side, then you don't know how to do computation on the other side. Or it's difficult to do computations on the other side that you can meaningfully compare. So for example, this has been done extensively considering supersymmetry, where there are certain observables that are protected as you increase the interactions. So for those, you can make a meaningful comparison and so on. So again, for certain observables, you can take into account quantum corrections, finite coupling effects, all of that. But this is not the regime I'm talking about. So I'm restricting myself to the weakly coupled regime in gravity, which is just classical Einstein-Hilbert. And this maps to this infinitely strongly coupled large n limit in the gauge theory. So we're not sensitive to quantum effects, basically, in the gravity set. OK, so the outline of the rest of the talk is as follows. So first, I will spend some time describing the gravitational duals of these gauge theories that have confinement. And because these are a class of spacetimes that go under the name of ADS soliton, and they are interesting in their own right, as we shall see. Then I will describe how we evolve dynamical black holes in such backgrounds. Then I'll just present some results and I'll finally conclude. So as I said, if you have questions, just interrupt anytime. All right, so what is the ADS soliton? So let's start first with the planar black hole in ADS. That's just the analog of the Schwarzschild solution in the Poincaré patch of ADS. So If you forget about these Fs, this is just the Poincaré patch of ADS. Okay? So this F is just the usual function that has a simple zero. So this is a black hole with planar topology. So these coordinates, principle, they are just flat directions, which extend infinite. So this is the topology of a horizon is R3. Okay? So now suppose that, so that's the planar ADS Schwarzschild solution. It has this simply the same general diagram, except for there's a time-like path. So now suppose I do the following coordinate transformation. You send t to minus I theta, so that's now an angle, and you say you send this w to I t. So this metric becomes this one here. This is a solution to the Einstein equations in five dimensions, in this case with a cosmological constant, negative cosmological constant. Now, the time direction is essentially trivial. So sorry, I should have said that the boundary of ADS is at z equals 0, z equals infinity, that's the singularity. So now this is trivial, and now we have this factor here. So if you recall the Euclidean Schwarzschild solution, then you have to choose the period of the time coordinate to be a certain one so that the space just caps off in a smooth manner. So the same here. If you want to avoid a singularity at the zero of this function, you are forced to choose the period of this angular coordinate to be this one here. And now this space extends only to some finite value of z where it caps off smoothly, just as the Euclidean Schwarzschild solution does. OK? So this is the ADS soliton space. And the fact that now you have this function, which this introduces scale in the problem, this breaks conformal invariance. OK? It turns out that these spaces have been looked at in holography for some time. And this gentleman conjectured that considering spaces with the same boundary conditions, then this is a minimum energy state of the theory. And if you choose suitable zero of energy, then you see that there is a mass gap in this theory. So the next excited state corresponding to a black hole with these boundary conditions sits at some finite mass away from this solution. And in fact, the stability of this spacetime has been looked at by mathematicians recently, in particular Piotr Kruschel and others. And they could prove rigorously, at least for a certain class of perturbations, that indeed these spaces are stable. OK?
Is any d regardless?
Yeah, this is true in any d.
No, but I mean, you have a line element that only has.
Yeah, so here this should be d equals 4. So that's the number of boundary directions. So in this particular case, it's 4. OK? This construction just follows in any number of dimensions. OK? So this is the ADS soliton background, and that's the vacuum of the theory with these boundary conditions. And to be more specific, boundary conditions such that one of the angles is periodic. OK? So if now one is interested in finite temperature, then we have to move to the Euclidean. And then if you consider Euclidean black holes as well, and you periodically identify the Euclidean time with some period beta, which is the inverse of the temperature, then you find that there are two static solutions with the same boundary conditions. So namely, there's the black brain, which if you're periodically, if you go to the Euclidean and you identify the Euclidean time, then again, it has the same structure as the Euclidean Schwarzschild solution. Space will just cap off at some finite distance, which is where the horizon would be. Okay? Whilst on the other hand, this angular direction, which in the previous slide I call omega, then if you can periodically, you can choose whatever period you want here, right? Because it's the coefficient is trivial. So this other angular direction just never caps off anywhere. So it's always finite. On the other hand, for the ADS soliton, because the Euclidean time now is trivial, you can choose whatever period you want, which means that this solution exists for any temperature. But on the other hand, the angular direction now caps off at some finite distance along the holographic direction. Okay? So when you have now these two solutions that both exist for any temperature, you can then compute the free energy and see which one dominates. And what one finds is that at high temperatures, it is a black brain which has lowest free energy, whilst at low temperatures, it is the ADS soliton that dominates the canonical ensemble. And there's a first order phase transition between these two spacetimes at some critical temperature, which is very much analogous to the Hawking-Page phase transition in ADS. Okay, and you can argue that this is a confinement-deconfinement phase transition from the point of view of the gate theory. In particular, the stress energy tensor dual to this object is a thermal stress energy tensor, which scales according to the number of colors in the theory, whilst this is basically the vacuum. Okay, so that's the first order deconfinement phase transition at some critical temperature. At this critical temperature, it turns out that basically this critical temperature corresponds to the case where the thermal circle and the compact circle have the same circumference. Okay, so at this temperature, these authors found that there exists a new gravitational solution corresponding to a domain wall. So in half of the space, you have like a black brain. So in this region of the space, you have that the thermal circle cuts off at some distance, whilst the other one just remains finite for any value. Whilst in the other half of the space, it's the opposite. So it's the Euclidean time circle that never vanishes, whilst the other circle just cuts off at some finite distance. And then there's some domain wall solution. Okay, this solution only exists at precisely the deconfinement, the critical temperature. So if you have these type of domain wall type solutions, then this author's conjecture that you could have finite size black hole solutions. So this is what me and my student looked at a few years ago. And we found that at temperatures higher than the deconfinement phase transition temperature, then you find small localized black holes at the bottom of these geometries. So when the temperature is very, very high, these are finite size spherical black holes that sit at this bottom of the geometry. And they actually resemble qualitatively and quantitatively with an asymptotically flat Schwarzschild black hole. It's just that this is a tiny black hole, which is much smaller than any other relevant scale in the problem. And just as asymptotically flat black holes, when they are very small, the temperature is very high. So in particular, they are thermodynamically unstable, so and they are subdominant in the thermal ensemble.
So here, in the setup, you put in the boundary conditions, you have a large temperature localized somewhere, and that determines what the black hole.
Yeah, you fix. So what you do, you have to set the scale. You have to fix this, which basically sets the size of the compact circle. And then you've got a one-parameter family of solutions, which is the temperature. So when the temperature is very high, you find that there exists a localized black hole. Which
is the temperature is high in some patch. If I go.
Yeah. So in other words, the time circle only vanishes in a tiny inner region here, which is where the black hole sits. As you decrease the temperature and approach the deconfinement, the critical temperature, then these black holes grow, and actually they spread along the infrared bottom of the geometry, and they become like pancakes. And as you keep approaching the critical temperature, they become larger and larger. So for a larger and larger portion of the horizon, this basically looks like a black brain, but at some point just cuts off. And these are all topologically spherical black holes with finite energy. And they are static. And they correspond from the point of view of the dual gauge theory to just having a ball of deconfined plasma that sits in a vacuum and is stable because you have a surface tension in this case that prevents this from just blowing up. Right?
Have you known there's a horizon?
Well, this is just a static solution. You can construct it. By construction, you is from the point of view of constructing static black holes, this is a boundary value problem. So you can impose that there is a horizon as part of your boundary data.
It's a null surface.
As null surface, just as any other normal horizon. And then, as I said, locally, this looks like, in this case, like a black brain, like one of these black holes that I just showed you earlier.
What about singularities?
Well, these solutions, we only constructed them numerically, so we did not study the would-be Penrose diagram. But given that they resemble like asymptotically flat black holes, and there's a continuous parameter that moves you along the family, I would say that the Penrose diagram is just like the Penrose diagram of the short shell black hole with a space-like singularity.
When the star collapses, all the matter goes to singularity.
We will see black holes forming in later in this talk. Yeah, but we will form these type of black holes dynamically later in the talk. And we basically, the black holes we form settle to the class of static solutions that we constructed numerically by just solving the corresponding elliptic problem. So, as I said, these black holes are duals to static bubbles of deconfined plasma sitting in the vacuum, and they are static because here you have a surface tension, which is something that you don't have in a conformal field theory. Classically, these black holes are expected to be stable, even though no one has ever done a detailed analysis of the perturbations of these objects, but just by symmetry, they ought to be stable. And as I said, the behavior and actually their physical properties interpolate between those of an asymptotically flat black hole and those of a black brain. And in particular, the way that they should relax to equilibrium should basically interpolate between these two. And this is relevant in order to establish the regime of validity or when hydrodynamics applies in the dual gate state. And we'll see that.
The bubble of deconfined QCD that you said this is dual to,
yes.
Which stage of the evolution in the original diagram is that? Is that the hydrodynamic regime? Is that the hydrogenization regime?
So that would be the hydrogenization regime.
So during the hydrogenization process, there are bubbles of deconfined QCDs?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
In the case of a collision, you form a deconfined plasma only just after the collision. So after the hydronization is when you form individual hadrons. We will see in this picture, basically hadrons are gravitational waves. I will explain this in a sec. Well, actually now. So it turns out that in these spaces, gravitational perturbations or any other type of perturbations, they form a complete set of gap normal modes. So they are massive, and there's some. They propagate on the light cone and inside the light cone, and they form a set of gap states with a mass gap, which is basically dual to the lambda QCD scale.
How do you know it's a complete set?
I don't have a proof, but I think from the point of view of the Sturm-Liouville theory, around the ADS soliton, then they should form a complete set. I mean, for black holes, that. Around the ADS soliton, but not around a black hole. But for ADS soliton, the operator is emission. Yeah, and they form an infinite tower of massive states. So the fact that these states are gapped has implications on how the theory behaves, because you may or may not be able to excite certain modes. So it's unclear how you approach equilibrium in this state. And as I said, this is not yet studied in detail. But the point being, in this theory, you can identify these gravitational waves with particles in the dual gauge. So this allows you to talk about distributions and these sort of things, which are observables in the gauge theory. Okay. So, what do we want to do with this? So first, we would like to understand the dynamics of black holes in this background, see how they equilibrate when hydrodynamics provides a good description of the dynamics of the gauge theory when, And ultimately, we would like to study collisions of black holes in this background as models for heavy ions in QCD, where again, we have confinement. And in this background, we can capture the physics of confinement deconfinement, which has not been done before. So just to reiterate that in these models, in principle, we can capture the various stages of the collision that I alluded to earlier. So for example, if you collide two compact objects, which may or may not be black holes, they may form an excited state, which may be very much deformed, so that in the far from equilibrium regime, this object will then gradually radiate the non-spherical modes and will expand in an almost conformal way, just as you would see in QCD. But at some point, it will reach the confinement scale and it will settle down to a plasma ball, which will continue to radiate. These are the hadrons, the gravitational waves that one can associate to hadrons in the gauge theory. So ideally, this is what we would like to do. We are not there yet, but in principle, we could do it. So in this talk, I will consider a simpler problem, which is to study the final stages of a relaxation. Now, once preparing the talk, I just realized that this looks like a piece of shit. This is not intentional, but it's just meant to signify a highly deformed black hole, which would relax through the
ghost.
Yeah. Okay. A black Halloween ghost that will gradually radiate away all these modes, and we want to understand how these various modes interact and how these approaches one of these plasma balls. Yes.
It's just a joke. Black holes is the most perfect object in the universe. Completely right.
Yes. But well, this refers to an equilibrium black hole. These are not equilibrium black holes.
No.
But anyway, so this is what we want to study. So let's see how we do it. So as I said, these spaces, they have a boundary. So you have to provide boundary conditions. So it's an initial boundary value problem. And we found it useful. We found that it was work much better if one uses generalized harmonic coordinates. So one has to solve just basically wave equations. And just for convenience, we couple gravity to a scalar field. The reason is that it's just easier to construct excited black holes, which are deformed from spherical symmetry by just using the suitable initial scalar field profile. But this is just for convenience. There's nothing fundamental about it. Okay. So it turns out that generalized harmonic coordinates, they work better because it's easier to understand the boundary conditions at the asymptotic boundary. Okay. This is the equation of motion for a lambda. Oh, that's the cosmological constant. So they have a negative cosmological constant.
It's kind of phi
on. Yes, because that's in five dimensions. And it's related to the scale L that I had in the previous slides. So in practice, the way we constructed this solution is just to consider the evolution of spaces in this form, where this is a background, which is the ADS soliton, and this is a perturbation, which need not be small. So in these problems, because they have a time-like boundary, it's not like in flat space that you can cut your domain at some finite distance and place outgoing radiation boundary conditions, then you get away with it. In this case, you can't do that because the boundary is part of the problem, so you need to reach to the boundary. And of course, it's at infinite physical distance, but null particles, they travel to the boundary back and forth in a finite time. So we need to place the boundary at some finite coordinate distance, so we just compactify this radial direction in some way. So the boundary now is at rho equals 1. And also, this circle now vanishes smoothly at rho equals 0. So basically, this is our choice. And there's nothing profound about it. It's just convenient to do it this way. In our simulations, we will assume that this direction remains symmetry, rotational symmetry. So effectively, we will be considering 3+1 dimensional problems. Okay? There are reasons why this would be interesting, but we will not do it for now. So as initial data, we construct time-symmetric initial data by just specifying a suitable profile for the scalar field, which we just deform in various ways, just breaking all symmetries. And moreover, we localize the scalar field at the bottom of the joint, I mean, near rho equals zero. Furthermore, we choose strong data so that either initially there's already a trapped surface, or this forms very quickly. And again, just because we are interested in studying the relaxation of these black holes. Okay? But in principle, one could use this scheme to simulate collisions and other type of data in which you do not form a black hole initially. Okay? But that's not what we do here. Because as I said, we have to impose boundary conditions. What we do is, again, we have a background, and then have another piece. And in order to identify how it has to fall off near the boundary, remind you, just rho equals 1, one can, in asymptotically ADS spacetime, one can construct analytically solutions near the boundary in the, using the so-called Pfefferman-Graham expansion. So from the Pfefferman-Graham expansion, you can determine what is the fall off of the perturbation so that you do not spoil the asymptotics. So what we do, we choose these factors according to Pfefferman-Graham expansion, and moreover, we then impose Dirichlet boundary conditions for all evolved variables. And this, in this case, turns out that these are the factors you get for the metric components. And for the scalar field, it's a different power. And for the source functions in the evolution equations for the coordinates, you get different powers by just demanding that the gauge and the constraints are satisfied near the boundary. At the bottom, where the compact circle shrinks to zero size smoothly, you have to make sure that the spacetime is smooth. So you impose standard regularity boundary conditions there. And along the transverse directions, along the sort of gauge theory directions, then again, here you can have, they are infinite, so you could have just radiation. But we were being a bit, lazy, and in the end, we just imposed Dirichlet, even though these are wrong. But this, of course, limits the evolution times, so that we can only evolve the system until the incoming waves just start contaminating the black hole. So we have to be careful with that. And in principle, we could impose outgoing boundary conditions, but we haven't done it yet. We will. So one key element in these simulations is how you fix the gauge, how you choose these source functions. And the way to do it is, once you have these expansions, you can plug them back into the equations of motion. And then you see that the equations of motion have some terms that diverge as you approach the boundary. By demanding that some of these diverging terms cancel, by choosing appropriately these source functions, this sort of tells you what is a good gauge choice near the boundary. Okay? And it turns out that if you impose these gauge conditions, not just near the boundary, but everywhere, we get stable evolutions. So that's what we did. And yeah, so as I said, this just gives, this seems to work and is robust. Okay. So this is just give you an idea of the type of initial conditions that we consider. The topology of the horizon is a three-sphere. So here I'm just showing the two-sphere sitting inside the three-sphere for one choice of initial conditions. So this is just the infrared bottom of the geometry. And this is just to show that this is highly deformed from spherical scene. And we achieve this by just playing with the profile of the scalar. And we have other profiles. But yeah, that's just an example. OK, so any questions so far before I go into the movies? Very good. So this is just an example of one of our simulations. In this case, because the scalar field is localized at the infrared bottom of the geometry, where the circle shrinks smoothly, we get away with just having like a fixed mesh hierarchy. But in principle, one could do AMR. That's fine, but we don't need it for this problem. So in this simulation, so here is where the circle shrinks smoothly. So this region here is where we excise, because that's already an apparent horizon, and that's the boundary of ABS. Okay, and this here is shown one of the transverse directions. Okay, so as I said, we choose strong data so that in the initial slice there's already a trap surface. So just let it go, and it's just the excise region, so the apparent horizon is somewhere there, and after some quick oscillations, it kind of settles to something. As I said, it approaches one of the static plasma balls that we construct. Okay, so to actually see more clearly what's going on, it's better to show this other movie. Here I'm going to show, there I was showing the scalar field. Again, here I'm also going to show the scalar field. And again, this is the bottom of the geometry where the circle shrinks to zero size. That's the boundary. And this is one of the transverse directions. Setting here, we cut the domain at some finite distance and impose Dirichlet boundary conditions, even though this is not what we should. But this is actually quite illustrative of what's going on in these type of spaces. So the scalar field basically just, as you can see, part of the scalar field bounces to the boundary, some other escapes. So in these geometries, you have some trapping in the ADS direction, but you can have dispersion in these transverse directions. But the scalar field, part of the scalar field, is trapped around the black hole. So you can have these multiple bounces that go back and forth and just keep interacting with the black hole and with themselves. So let me just show it again. So we have this competition of these two effects. You have these bounces, just as you have in ADS, but you have dispersion in the transverse directions, and you've got trapping near regions with strong gravity.
And is that why you end up with that holes going back and forth in a straight line, and not because there is, I think, in terms of kind of pressure picture, there is a lot less pressure to the side, so why is it not?
Yeah, actually, the way to see this is, for example, if you look at null geodesics in this plasma ball spacetime, so this is what I'm showing here. So this is one of these static plasma balls that we constructed. So that's the energy density distribution that you would get at the boundary. And this is the actual space, analogous to what I was showing now. So the black hole in this coordinate sits there, and it looks like a point, but this is just an illusion of these coordinates. So what we do here, you can shoot geodesics from the boundary at some angle. So if the black hole sits here. So you can see if you shoot the geodesics that you shoot in the opposite direction, just bend tiny little bit, but then just keep bouncing in almost these straight lines. And this is the sort of low gravity regions. Whereas in the regions where you have like strong gravity, then this is highly bent, and it just keeps bouncing back and forth. And it remains in this region for quite a while. So even though we haven't looked for it, it is not inconceivable that in these spacetimes you could form these kind of tiny black holes in regions over here. However, I'm not aware of islands of stability in this background. So it's not. I don't think that the analogs of the oscillons or geons exist. And as I said, this is more like ADS3, where you have a mass gap between, say, the mass of ADS and the first black hole. So this could just go on and on and on, depending on how you choose your initial pitch. So it's basically somewhere in between ADS and flat space. But basically, this trajectory of the null geodesic is what you've seen in the previous one.
So for these transverse directions,
yes.
Are they supposed to extend infinitely
yeah.
in each direction? Is that just compactified coordinates? Or?
Well, in the movie that we did, we use uncompactified coordinates, and we just cut the domain at some finite distance and impose the Dirichlet boundary, even though this is not correct. We should be imposing outgoing wave boundary conditions. But you could compactify those directions as well. It's just that in that case, we lost resolution as you go away, and then you gave some problems in some cases. But yeah. And of course, you could compactify these coordinates as well, but that's a different problem. And then you would be putting the system in a box, and then the physics would change but significantly. So one thing which I said one was interested is to try to identify particles in the gate theory. And as I said, in these geometries, scalar field or gravitational waves form this set of normal modes. So you can try to project into the set of normal modes and see how the energy is transferred between the various modes. And what you should see, at least in the models for heavy ions, is that if you wait long enough, the various modes should be coupled, right? Because you don't have any interaction. So this is what we're trying to do. But unfortunately, this is something a bit messy. This is just several of these modes. But you don't see nice, clear sinusoids, which is just a reflection of the fact that we haven't reached the decoupling yet. So there's still energy being transferred between the various modes. And one thing that we would like to understand better is, given that you have these gaps between the various modes, how energy works, how this transfer of energy works. So this is something we haven't worked out yet.
What is their projection here, the field over the whole space-time, or are they ADS boundary?
So this is at some finite distance from the black hole. We take the solution, we project onto one of the normal modes. This is for the scalar field. So we project the scalar field onto the various normal modes of the scalar field. You one could do the same with the gravitational perturbations.
And also, when you have some issue about the particular surface that you've taken, because you can take a slightly different surface at the same location, and that has a wiggle there, I can undo or...
Yeah, I mean, one has to be careful with it. And that's something we're still trying to figure out what is the best way to do. And one could project the whole space, and I think that would not be so much of a problem because the class of plasma balls that we've been able to construct, they are still small to medium size. So
you're not breathing off with the asymptotic behavior?
Yes. But the actual plasma balls that we construct, they are still relatively small. So they are more like spherical black holes. So they are small in a way. So if you project the whole space, then that region where you have a black hole and therefore a significant difference from ADS solid should be small. So that should work. But in principle, one would like to do it in some way, some asymptotic region. So, but we haven't figured this out yet. So as promised, in principle, one can read off the quantities from the boundary field theory, see what it's doing. So what I'm going to show you here is the evolution of the energy density in the lab frame of the gauge theory. So that's at time zero, because we have a non-trivial scalar field configuration, you already have some ball, some energy, which that's something. And then, so that is just the same, the evolution of the energy density for the same movie that I showed before. So, you see some oscillations, and then this is basically when the initial large wave hits the boundary. You can see there's no symmetry, and then it does whatever it has to do. But then it kind of relaxes into something, which almost settles. But then, it kind of settles. Then you can see periodically it gets excited again. And this is just because the various waves of the scalar field, they are trapped in the high curvature regions, and they just keep bouncing back and forth. And if you compute the time of travel for an analgesic, then that's basically the spacing between the various oscillations that you see. And again, you can compute, you can extract the various quantities from the field theory. And here what we were looking at is the energy density, that's this black curve. The other curves are the pressures. So that's the initial big bounds. But then you can see there's some spacing between these. And this is whenever the boundary gets hit by one of these scalar waves or gravitational waves after you excite the black hole. So actually, the space in between these two is essentially the time of travel for an analgesic to go back and forth from the boundary.
Have you computed the vorticity?
No, we have not computed that yet. And one of the things that we haven't done yet is to compare the stress energy tensor you read off to that of hydro with various orders in the hydrodynamic expansion. So that's one thing that we still need to do. So the point I want to make is that because you've got this trapping and the gravitational waves or scalar waves just keep bouncing back and forth, there are different equilibration scales. So first, this is controlled by the quasi-normal modes of the black hole you have. But then dispersion seems not to be very effective because the plasma ball is small. So not much gets absorbed. So it keeps bouncing back and forth. So the actual equilibration is very slow. Perhaps if you could construct larger plasma balls, then you get, of course, much larger absorptions, and then you have this slow hydrodynamic behavior at late times. But we haven't seen that yet because we construct black holes. So long wavelengths are not absorbed at all. So you keep having these bounces back and forth.
Normal modes of these collisions, are they known or not?
No, they're not known. We can
getting them here.
Yeah, precisely. We can read them all. And as I said, if the plasma holes are small enough, they should somehow compare well with quasi-normal of asymptotic black holes, short-shot black holes. All right, so since I'm nearly out of time, let me just recap. So we are studying dynamics of plasma balls in these type of geometries. As I said, we have not evolved for long enough so as to see the decoupling between the various modes. And then I think that's an observable that people doing heavy ions are interested in. So in principle, we can get it. We just need to evolve for longer. Another open question is when or if hydro is applicable. So that's something we are still looking at. But that since from gravity, you can extract the stress energy tensor from the field theory, you can address this question quantitatively. And the relaxation process is difficult. And well, it's difficult to understand because there are various scales in the problem. And we still have to disentangle them. And this, of course, depends very much on the size of the plasma balls that you form. And ultimately, we would like to study collisions as models for heavy ion in this series, because this would incorporate confinement into the game, which is something that's not been looked at before. And well, since today is Halloween, I thought I would just finish just showing some scary images to kind of get us into the mood to celebrate Halloween. So well, happy Halloween.
I have two questions, but get rid of this slide. It's distracting. Okay. So first of all, I think I missed something in the QCD description. What is the scalar field?
Oh, the scalar field. Well, that doesn't have an analog in QCD. It would be just adding a scalar.
Okay, fine. Okay.
A scalar in the theory. Higgs-like particle.
Okay. So what role does it actually play in the QCD like description, because you said that the gravitational waves give you the hadron spectrum, basically.
Yeah. So in QCD, if you couple QCD to a scalar field, say a Higgs or an inflaton, whatever, so that.
But like, why is it?
As I said, so here we just did it for convenience because it gave us an easy way to construct the type of initial conditions that we were after. But there's nothing fundamental about it, and it's not fundamental. It's not necessary. Okay. If one just solves the initial, if one solves the initial constraints, then you don't need it.
Okay, the other question, which may be not relevant, but for your initial conditions, do they take any sort of generalized Kerr-Shield form about the ADS-Soliton background?
No. So what we do, we use conformally flat initial data, and we specify the scalar field profile and then solve for the conformal factor. Just the standard.
So for this shockwave collision thing around the ADS soliton, there's no double Kerr-Shield thing?
Well, so for this shockwave collision in ADS soliton, there is no known analytic solution for that. What one would have to do, if you wanted to model this, you could construct like boosted black hole type initial data in this background. Now, of course, the background is not flat. So,
yeah, but you still have a linearized solution.
I don't think so. There is
superposed of curves, but those and with so, good to whatever separation you put them, that wouldn't be a solution to the initial value.
But in these spaces, just to reemphasize, the only analytically known solutions are either the vacuum or the black brain. So the localized black holes, they are not known analytically. So if you wanted to simulate a collision, you would have to take those, and which are only known numerically, and then boost them. So constructing such initial data is itself a non-trivial problem. Of course, it can be done, but it's not like you just add up two solutions as usually done in Poincaré ADS. Here, this background is much more complicated.
But in principle, just following up on that, you could given your solution now and given the solution we have in the localized solutions looked at this fundamentally, perhaps a reasonable picture of what the approximation
could be. Sure, yeah, in principle you could do these things. Hopefully it won't be too bad. But if you do it, probably, if you do what you say, you probably have access only to small type monoliths. And I think the ones that would be probably more interesting are the ones that are large.
I understand that approach. We solve black holes as a totally flat space. We see that across a logical space time, Einstein decision. So, how much can we remain effectively if you can transfer those standard as a totally space time?
I would say, because the asymptotics are totally different, I would say not much remains. Right? So here you're talking about black holes in the Sitter space, and these are totally different.
What about Minkowski space?
So only when black holes in these spaces are small compared to the other relevant scales that the actual vacuum has, then those apply.
Small,
because here you have a scale. The background has a scale, which is basically the sort of size of the compact circle. Right? So what you want are black holes that are small compared to that size. Right? So those behave pretty much like the asymptotically flat ones, because they're so small that the other scales are irrelevant.
It's called mean, small mean, small masses, small mass.
There's a ratio.
Yeah, it's a ratio. So solar masses, so I mean, in vacuum, you know, all black holes are the same, right? You just scale them up. So here, they are not all the same because you've got an intrinsic scale in your space, right? So you have to compare them to that scale. If that scale is 10 solar masses, then you want black holes that are probably 0.1 solar masses or even less. Those would be kind of small, right? So, but here the difference is that the background has a scale. So you have to compare the black holes to that scale.
So why don't you walk back in the
Einstein decision? Because the properties of the asymptotic boundary are totally different. So here we have a time-like boundary, and that's what allows us to sort of then infer properties. And this goes back to the conjecture itself, that only when you have these asymptotically ADS spaces, this conjecture is precisely formulated. So you can then solve the gravity problem and infer properties from the field theory. In the Sitter, we don't know, or in Minkowski, we don't know whether there is such a duality in the first place. Of course, then
we remain a conjecture.
It, even in ADS, it's a conjecture.
It's still a conjecture.
Yeah. So but at least here we have a well-defined.
Mathematics.
No. That's what we're saying. It's a conjecture. People keep exploring it. Here, the physical problem is not the gravity problem. The physical problem is what he wants to do with the field theories are.
Yeah.
The rest is a calculational tool. It's like the same thing as saying, we don't live in Fourier space. That doesn't invalidate the Fourier transformation as a very useful calculational tool. That's what he's taking in this approach.
A question?
No, this is a duality transfer.
So your argument stays, applies exactly to that.
He's not trying to solve gravitational physics in order to understand gravity. He's trying to solve gravitational physics in order to understand strong interaction.
Correct.
So, on the same topic, but to what extent is the potential modularity of conjecture compromise the duality that you're exploiting, or
so here, within this conjecture, you have access to certain class of quantum field theories. What properties of this class of quantum field theories that are accessible to this conjecture are relevant or mimic aspects of real-world quantum field theory? This is the question I'm trying to understand. So here we are saying another class which has another feature in common with real-world, which is the fact you have confined to confine. Whether this is useful or not remains to be seen.
And the case of the fluid gravity correspondence, maybe the CFT would be completely wrong. That would still stop.
So in case of what?
Fluid gravity correspondence. The correspondence of some regime in the gravitational, of gravitational problems being dual to some particular fluids, that stands regardless of the CFT being important.
So I was wondering, I mean, if you try to do this with like a spinning black hole,
mm-hmm.
what about, could you, like, if you have, for example, a super radiance process, what that would be on the boundary? What would that represent? Do you have any intuition of that?
Well, you can study super radiance in ADS, just forgetting about all I said today.
Yeah, but
right?
I'm interested in what happens here.
Well, what happens to super radiance in ADS is still an open problem.
Okay.
Again, it's an instability. So it's an instability on both sides.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So that's clear.
But one of these sides could be physical, unlike ADS. Like, ADS is not physical, but this boundary theory could be something in the real world.
So again, for the case that where this is studied or well defined, then again the boundary theory lives on a free sphere. Right? I mean, how physical is it to put a quantum field theory on a sphere? Again, probably in the real world we don't do that, but I think mathematically it's a perfectly well posed problem, well defined setting for quantum field theories, and then you can study that. And it's again, the endpoint of this instability is not known. Could be that you form a singularity, in which case that may just be a quantum effect, a 1 over n effect in the field theory, which is absolutely fine. So
the radiance, you need a Kerr-type solution.
Yes. Yes.
You don't have that.
Well, you need rotation.
Yes.
So you could have this. You could have rotating black holes in this setting as well. It's just that they are more complicated to construct. The static ones are homogeneity too. So if you have add rotation, you break another symmetry. So that's homogeneity 3. So it's a more difficult problem, but it's perfectly well defined. You could do it. And then you could look at super radiance or so on.
Okay. If there are no further questions, let's thank Paul again.
Thank you.